This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Parents who send their children to a neighborhood school in a small California city were devastated over the announcement that the school will be shut down. Then they started taking action.
I'm pretty sure you guys all have kids, and you guys should know like the stressfulness of trying to find another school, a perfect fit for them.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll tell you about the fight to save Fair Oaks Elementary in Redwood City, California. Then we'll meet a high school English teacher who has published a series of young adult fiction books with the help of some unusual editors, the students in his creative writing class. And we'll spend an academic minute at recess. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. A few months ago, parents in Redwood City, California, about 25 miles south of San Francisco, learned their long-standing elementary school was facing almost certain closure. The reason? Declining enrollment due to, among other factors, competition from three independent charter schools. The district was projecting only 146 students at Fair Oaks Elementary for the next school year, down from nearly 500 a decade ago. The Redwood City School District superintendent wrote parents a letter and told them Fair Oaks would close by summer and students would be transferred to three other larger district schools. The district relies on state funding that's tied to student attendance, but it doesn't get that money for kids at charter schools. So as more families pull their kids out of district schools in favor of charters, the district finds itself in a budget crunch. Still, that expected closure of Fair Oaks Elementary School didn't quite go down the way anyone expected. The program Cross Currents ran this story from Lee Romney back in May, the day before an important deadline.
Let me tell you a little bit about Fair Oaks Elementary. It serves an almost entirely Spanish-speaking neighborhood, and more than 80% of students are considered socioeconomically disadvantaged. The school provides all kinds of services to families, like English language classes, career support, and a food pantry. So in late March, when the superintendent sent out his letter proposing the closure of Fair Oaks, the whole neighborhood was pretty much stunned.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands.
2 days later, families stream into a San Mateo County Board of Supervisors meeting. The board has no authority over the school district, but the parents come anyway to beg for help. They make it clear they plan to fight. The thought of having to start all over at a strange school really upsets parent Jessica McDonald.
It's just really stressful trying to get to know new other staff members and letting them know about our kids' conditions. I'm pretty sure you guys all have kids, and you guys should know like the stressfulness of trying to find another school, a perfect fit for them.
Then a parent who's volunteered for a decade at Fair Oaks steps up to the dais.
Buenos días, mi nombre es Gloria Rangel.
In her hand, Gloria holds loose-leaf sheets of paper.
El superintendente quiere cerrar esa escuela porque él habla de números.
She says the superintendent wants to close this school based on the numbers. But in just one day, we've gathered a list of names of parents who said they do plan to enroll for fall. They just haven't gotten around to it yet.
Tengo más firmas aquí del número que él ya ha hablado.
I have more signatures here, she tells the board, than the total number he's using. Gloria and most other parents live close to Fair Oaks. It's a community gathering spot. They feel safe there. The one thing I want to say, she tells the board, is if Fair Oaks School is the community's school, why kick out the community to make room for other kids? A week later, on April 4th, parents and students carry banners and signs and march 2 miles to attend a school district board meeting. It's not fair to us that overnight they're telling us they're going to close the school, one mom tells a local Telemundo reporter.
Algunas palabras para el superintendente.
He asks her if she has anything to say to the superintendent.
Oh my God, no supiste con quién te metiste.
You had no idea, she says, who you were messing with. That school board meeting on April 4th doesn't go well for anyone, really. Parents ask, is the decision final or is there room to fight together? The answer? The decision has been made. Parents walk out in protest. The board delays the vote for 3 weeks until April 25th.
When you speak to the board, please try to share with us relevant information. Stay on topic.
But once that meeting gets started, something unexpected happens. Superintendent John Baker says he and several board members have been meeting with the Fair Oaks parents who are fighting the closure. He says he now gets just how much is at stake for them.
The families care about Fair Oaks. This is a hub for them of where they can go to get some other emotional, physical needs now.
He also pretty much admits the parents were blindsided. Then he offers a surprising compromise. The school will stay open next year, he says, if the parents can do some fast recruiting and ensure that at least 200 students enroll for fall by May 15th. Parents, he says, have to stay involved with the school and help boost attendance, which is the lowest in the district. And they have to sign agreements promising to help their kids with schoolwork.
So that we can make sure that we are going to have children make academic gains at our school.
Because test scores, they've been the lowest in the district, too. Remember Gloria Rangel, the mom who waved those sheets of parent signatures at county supervisors in late March? Well, ever since then, she's been leading the parent committee fighting the Fair Oaks closure. And even she didn't see this compromise from the district coming. When she steps up to the microphone, she ditches her prepared comments to thank Baker and school board members. For the first time, she says, I feel heard. And we were not feeling heard. From the date of this meeting, Gloria and the other parents have 20 days to meet the enrollment goal. They're optimistic. Here's another parent organizer, Lily Silva. She says the same way the independent charter schools do their propaganda, we're going to do our marketing the same way to promote our school and our district. But there are reasons why parents have switched their kids over to charters. The one that's growing the fastest here is called KIPP Excelencia. KIPP rents space from the district at two separate schools. The superintendent's plan, the one that might get put on hold, actually calls for KIPP to consolidate and move on to the Fair Oaks campus. I head over to a KIPP campus as parents are dropping their kids off.
Hi, are you a KIPP parent?
Yes, I am.
This is Jessica Rodriguez. Every day, she ferries six kids to and from KIPP Excelencia schools.
It's my sister's kids, my kids, and my other brother's kids.
Jessica says she took her daughters out of other district schools, not Fair Oaks. The youngest, in second grade.
She didn't know anything, like no ABCs, no numbers. When I transferred her here to a charter school, when I heard about KIPP, they started teaching her everything. We all get together with the teachers, the parents, put a plan together for the student and make, you know, decisions based on what their needs are.
So can Fair Oaks compete? I head there next. Large vinyl signs hang from the fence announcing that new student registration is now open. The district just put them up, right next to the hand-lettered sign in Spanish that says, Save Our School. A lot of the parents work multiple jobs. The moms who don't are de facto childcare workers. Two of them roll their strollers past the school office while chatting.
La Fair Oaks.
¿Por qué?
Porque sí.
This little guy is only three, but he says he wants to go to Fair Oaks. Then Gloria Rangel, the parent leader, shows up.
¿Cómo está?
Bien, gracias, contenta.
A staff member lets us into room 20, where Gloria's been signing up families. A rotating crew of parents has been helping. Today, a mom and a teacher pop in to chat. Gloria tells them how stressed out she's been. But last night, she says, she finally slept well. That's because they hit their mark. The parents have gotten signed commitments from about 220 students so far. Plenty don't drive. And Gloria says those who are undocumented have been worried that if they had to walk to a more distant school, they'd be more likely to get snatched up in an immigration raid and separated from their children.
Miedo,
y se sienten seguros de que nomás brincan la calle y ya están adentro de la escuela.
Here, she says, they feel safe knowing that they can just dash across the street and be inside the school. Gloria says she just found out the district can offer a workshop about how to prepare for potential deportation. And district staff has offered to help Gloria teach a class to other parents about how to get more involved in their kids' schooling and boost their reading levels. She says that partnership is long overdue. All four of her kids have attended Fair Oaks. Her daughter still does. But Gloria has felt the decline. Art and sports programs disappeared. Teachers left. So did families. Though she's grateful for the chance to save the school, she puts a lot of blame on the district. She says the quality of the school dropped and dropped, and they never focused on why. They completely abandoned the school. That we have to step up and work with them is clear, Gloria says, but they need to put a little more into doing their part, too.
Pero ellos tienen que poner un poquito más de su parte para que...
The superintendent wasn't available for an interview, but a spokesman said the district is committed to helping parents meet the conditions of the compromise. For Cross Currents, I'm Lee Romney in Redwood City.
And now a quick update. Just after this story first aired, Superintendent John Baker's office released a message on Facebook. Part of the message read, "The Board of Trustees and I are appreciative and proud that you helped other parents commit to Fair Oaks for the 2018-19 school year, which was one of the main conditions that we agreed upon. You met this condition and you achieved it well before the May 15th deadline. You should be very proud of this achievement. We are. We thank parent leader Gloria Rangel and all of you who support her in her work. Please continue to do so if she needs your help to meet the rest of the conditions. As you know, our next step is to make sure that these students attend Fair Oaks in 2018-19, as we'll continue to review the numbers and make sure that we remain fiscally responsible while operating Fair Oaks Elementary School." Still to come, an English teacher who writes young adult fiction makes editing the books part of the class. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Bruce Ingram always wanted to be a teacher. He also really wanted to be a writer. And for many years, he did both, writing articles and books about outdoors life and conservation. But the bug to write fiction was always there. And a couple of years ago, he finally published his first book of young adult fiction called Ninth Grade Blues. Now he has a second book out called 10th Grade Angst. He says he owes a huge debt to his students for the voice of the book. I spoke to Bruce Ingram about where he got the idea for these stories.
Okay, well, let me give you some background on that, because this was not a straight line to success, obviously. I've always wanted to be a writer, and by the time I was a junior in high school, I decided that I wanted to teach and write for a living, that I wanted to have two jobs. So I've had a series of teaching jobs. The last 30-plus years, I've been with Botetourt County's public schools in Botetourt, Virginia. So I started writing as a second job because I enjoy writing. But it was also something I could do at home at night after I did my schoolwork, and that I could do on weekends and in the summertime. So June or July of 2016, I wrote the first 8 chapters of Ninth Grade Blues, 2 chapters each of the 4 characters, Luke, Ellie, Marcus, and Mia. So I sent him to a publisher. He said he was intrigued, finished the book. So I worked on the book the rest of the summer, wrote the other 52 chapters. And then I went to our assistant principal at school, Amanda Collins, and asked her if I could have my creative writing class students proof the book and make suggestions, sort of like a class project. And I didn't want to do something like that without permission, you know, because we were going to be taking class time up for that. She was thrilled with the idea. She thought it'd be a great way to improve this kid's writing skills and their editing skills and their punctuation skills. And, you know, word choice. I mean, these are all state standards of things that we're supposed to be doing. And then I told her that Kendall Lively, the librarian, said that we could Skype with a publisher when kids had finished editing the book. And the publisher was good with that. So in September, October of 2016, my creative writing kids, they proofed the book. They made a ton of suggestions. I'm changing everything they say, just about. And it reads much better after they're done with it. So in November, we used Skype with the publisher, talking to the kids. I'm in the background. And he says, what do y'all think of a sequel? Well, my kids, of course, say, yeah, a sequel would be great. They own this book. They've worked on the book. They've edited the book. And then they start giving him ideas for sequels. And I'm back in the back, not saying a word. And I'm thinking, has he bought the first one and wants the second one? This went right past the rewrite stage. He wanted a sequel.
Well, it sounds like the students gave you the rewrite.
Yeah, the students gave me the rewrite. They're exactly right. I mean, my creative writing kids are just fantastic. And it's an elective, and they take the class because they want to. And lots of them have had me for English and have enjoyed our time together and know that I love having them in class, and so they want to take the class. When I first started teaching the creative writing class, I only had 6 kids in it. And now our assistant principal told me before school let out, we got something like 70 kids who want to take creative writing.
How different is the story now from when you showed it to the students than when you got it back from the students? What kind of changes did they make?
I think the best thing the students did was word choice. For example, when we were working on the 10th grade book in class last year, there was this section where Ellie was getting ready to go out on a date. And in the draft I showed to the kids, I had her putting on makeup. Well, the boys and the girls, the boys just go right by, you know. And then one of the girls says, nobody calls it makeup anymore. And then another one says, yeah, we need to call this blush. And then another girl said, no, we need to call it rouge. And then the girls started arguing over whether blush or rouge was the right word in this section. Then they look over to me for guidance, and I look at the guys, and the guys and I are looking at each other. We don't know what to put here. And finally I say, I think I speak up for all the guys when I say, you all decide. When y'all come to the decision, that's what it's going to be. We don't know enough about this to make it a good decision. So the girls discussed 5 to 10 minutes on this, how her makeup or blush or rouge was going to be, how she was going to apply it, what it was going to be like, and how the sentence was going to read. You know, we project the book onto the board, and they're cutting and they're deleting and they're adding. And finally, they said, we're done. It's fixed.
Nice.
And then we went on to the next paragraph. And I'll never forget that. I mean, that was such good learning, and the students had control, and they were making decisions. This is a lot of fun as a teacher to be with such creative young people.
How many of these stories that you tell did you actually see happen during a school year? I'm sure some of the things that happened to Marcus you saw happen to other football players.
Yes. One of my 10th grade boys a year and a half ago had an ACL injury, and he helped me write that chapter. And I told him I was going to use his experiences in the book, and he was very okay with that. And just like Marcus, he was just really worried about his future sports activities and, you know, just worrying about whether his leg was going to be okay again. I mean, that came straight from the kids. That same class insisted that in the 10th grade book when I was writing it, that I write about their driving experiences, that 1 4-chapter arc be about getting their driver's license and going through the learner's permit process. Every single anecdote about mishaps behind the wheel came from kids in that 10th grade honors class.
How different do you think these stories would have been had you written them when we were going to high school, way back in the olden days?
Well, I think the voice of today's kids comes through in the books. But, you know, some things never change. First date, first crush, taking a chance to ask somebody out, trying to get to know somebody better, feeling your way through these relationships. I don't think that's ever going to change. Those are universal things, I believe. Your hopes and your fears when you're in high school, I don't think those ever change. What am I going to do? I mean, some of the kids realize in 9th grade, and some of them don't realize when they graduate what they want to do. And that's a process, too, on their ways to becoming productive adults. you know, there's things that are different. Obviously, the technology is vastly different. But a lot's different, but a lot's the same, too. You know, I was sort of in a stride two universes here when I wrote these books. There was Bruce Ingram, the teacher, and Bruce Ingram, the writer. So I wrote these books with plenty of high school drama, but I didn't want anything in the books to be embarrassing to my school system or to my administrators or my fellow English teachers. So there's no profanity, there's no sex, there's no drug use in the books. I wanted the books to be clean so that parents wouldn't be worried and my administrators wouldn't be worried. So there's tons of high school drama, my gosh. But I just felt like I could write a good story without doing other things.
Bruce Ingram is a high school English teacher in Daleville, Virginia, and the author of many outdoors guidebooks. His latest book of young adult fiction is called 10th Grade Angst. Students love recess. However, they also love not moving and getting exercise. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Kids love recess. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Steve Ball, professor of nutrition and exercise physiology at the University of Missouri, describes how to ensure kids use recess to get their allotted amount of daily exercise.
Most grade school students are likely to claim recess as their favorite period of the day. However, in many cases, many students are not engaging in enough physical activity during recess. We found that zones with specific games can improve physical activity, improving a child's chance of engaging in the recommended 60 minutes of play per day. We found that average physical activity increased by 10%, and children averaged 175 more steps on a zone playground compared to a traditional one. Research indicates that active children are healthy children. Moreover, past research has shown that activity helps academic performance. By reworking traditional recess games to be more vigorous, children are able to increase their physical activity in a real easy way, improving their health, and even improving how they do in school. Zoning a playground involves dividing the existing recess area into separate zones. Each zone has a specific activity associated with it, and traditional recess games such as basketball and kickball are reworked to maximize activity. Kickball, for instance, can be reworked to hustle kickball, where children kick the ball and run in rapid fire rather than waiting in line to kick. Once the playground zones were put in place, we tracked the physical activity of participants through the use of accelerometers, which are similar to a Fitbit, and looked at physical activity compared to a traditional playground without the zones. We found a significant increase in physical activity among zoned playground children. Playground zoning is one way schools can be proactive in their students' health and wellness. Recess is one way for young children to be active, and through playground zoning, schools can ensure that children are achieving the maximum benefit during recess.
That was Steve Ball of the University of Missouri. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.